This is the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. This is episode 273. I'm your host, Jess Root from CardsWire.com, and in this edition, we will not have Seth Cox with us. He gets another week off of this. In fact, we've got one more week because we have our second of three season previews where we look at the opponents that the Arizona Cardinals have. In our last episode, in our last edition of the show, we previewed the Cardinals' first four opponents of the year: the San Francisco 49ers, the Washington football team, the Detroit Lions, and Carolina Panthers, each interviewing a writer that covers the team for one of our sister sites in the NFL Wire for USA Today. In this edition of the show, episode 273, I have the Cardinals' next four opponents that we'll take a look at, where we've got the Week 5 action against the New York Jets, Week 6 on Monday Night Football against the Dallas Cowboys, Week 7 against the Seattle Seahawks, and then after their Week 8 bye, the Miami Dolphins. So I've got guests for each of those teams. Let's go ahead and get started. To kick things off, we'll start with Week 5. At the New York Jets, the Arizona Cardinals will travel to play the Jets in the second of three consecutive road games, playing in Week 5 on the road. He'll get to face Sam Darnold and company, the Jets, and to help us find out more about the Jets' offseason and the upcoming season, I've invited Jets Wire managing editor, that's JetsWire.com, part of the NFL Wire's family, like CardsWire.com, and the managing editor to help us out is Gary Phillips. Again, Gary Phillips from JetsWire.com. Gary, how you doing?
I'm doing good, man. How are you doing?
Doing great. Glad to have you on. Appreciate the time that you're taking off. So kind of to go through what we're going to do, I want to just kind of go kind of chronologically about how the season went last year, off-season changes, impact losses, and how they'll affect the team, impact additions, draft type of things, and then kind of the expectations for the season, as well as how you think the Jets and the Cardinals matchup will look, how do they match up against each other. So let's go ahead and get started. Talk 2019. All things considered, the Jets ended up finishing with a better record than I think people realized that they did. Tell us about last season. What went right? What went wrong? And how did that compare to kind of what expectations were?
So last year was Adam Gase's first in New York, and it got off to a brutal 1-7 start. You know, I mean, a lot of injuries. Sam Darnold gets mononucleosis of all things at the start of the
Sam
season.
Sam Darnold memes were the best.
It was a really brutal year. You know, the team finished 7-9, like you said, better than the Cards, but it really wasn't impressive by any stretch of the imagination. Even the winning streak at the end of the year, you know, they went 6-2 to finish the season. A lot of that was because Greg Williams led defense, you know, an injury-plagued defense that was starting no names and journeymen and scrubs, and they overachieved. You know, the Jets had a string of three straight games in the middle of the season where they scored 34 points, and it looked like, all right, maybe Gase's offense and Darnold, that they're finally clicking. But over the last couple games of the season, they averaged under 16 points a game. I mean, there was nothing to write home about as far as the offense or Adam Gase in his first season. So the hope that they turn that around this year, you know, they got a lot of new offensive linemen. They've got a few new skill position players, but it's going to be tough.
So how was Darnold's play? I mean, Darnold's, I know he's got the talent to be really good, but he also has the decision-making to be really bad. What was your take on his season last year, his sophomore season, and what sort of quarterback do you see him becoming? Who's the quarterback that he kind of reminds you of?
Well, let's start with last season. I mean, it was inconsistent. There's no other way to put it. Was that necessarily all his fault? No, but, you know, focusing on what he can control, he needs to get better at his decision making. He needs to get better at becoming at his pocket passes. You know, when he stays in the pocket, he needs to be better with his play calls at the line of scrimmage, reading defenses. Now, he's got these flashes where, especially when he's outside of the pocket, when he's on the run, he can work some magic. I mean, he can make some crazy plays, the type of stuff that you see in video games, but that's not a recipe for winning football games. Now, as far as not being his fault, it's his second season in the NFL. He's with his second head coach, a brand new offense under Gase. He essentially didn't have an offensive line blocking for him last year. You know, he didn't really, you know, same thing with Le'Veon Bell. He didn't have anybody to run behind. So that kind of mitigates that big offensive weapon that you added in the offseason. Robbie Anderson and Jamison Crowder were the only two guys he really had to throw to. There was nobody there really to help him out. With that said, he needs to be better in year three.
Good stuff. Now, Adam Gase is an interesting case for me. The Jets wanted,
one way to put it.
When the Cardinals, because the Cardinals considered, they interviewed him, and there were a lot of people here that were really thrilled about it and wanted him to be the hire. And I've always wondered about, so he didn't particularly do well in Miami. He's got, he kind of reminds me of Todd Haley in terms of abrasive personality. What's your take on Gase and how he's done so far? Because it could have gone either way, I think, where the Jets could have had Kingsbury and the Cardinals Gase, but it ended up being the other way around.
I think that's probably a scenario Jets fans dream about. my take on him is that, you know, he was a bad play caller last year. I mean, say what you want about the talent that he had to work with or the fact that, you know, he inherited a roster that was built by a GM, Mike Maccagnan, who's no longer with the team. But he wasn't good last year. He wasn't a good play caller. And, you know, like I said before, Greg Williams made a mountain out of nothing with the defense that he had and the injuries that he had on that side of the ball. You know, Adam Gase is supposed to be this offensive genius, and he was supposed to take Sam Darnold to the next level. He was supposed to maximize a dual threat in Le'Veon Bell. He was supposed to, you know, make Robbie Anderson into a far more refined route runner and overall receiver than he was in his previous years in the league. And none of that really happened under Gase last year. So he's got some better pieces now on his offense. We know that the defense is capable. There's no excuses here in year two. I mean, if they don't win, and it's going to be hard for them to do so because there's better teams in the division and they've got an incredibly tough schedule. But if they don't show results and that offense doesn't do better than ranking near last in the league in every major category, that's going to be it for him and possibly overall as a head coach.
Let's fast forward to the offseason now. Who are the impact losses that in free agency, how will that affect them? And then who have they added to the roster that Cardinals fans should be able to pay attention to, especially in that matchup?
So the only big loss really was Robbie Anderson. You know, that was probably the guy that Sam Darnold had the most rapport with in his first 2 years in the league, you know, biggest connection with. He's gone to Carolina. The Jets brought in Rashad Perriman, very similar skill set to Anderson, much smaller sample size as far as success goes. You know, he really is only lived up to that number one pick potential in the final 5-6 games with Tampa Bay last year. So the Jets are banking big on that not being a fluke, which, you know, seems like a very Jets thing to do. But, you know, they also drafted Denzel Mims, you know, a rookie wide receiver out of Baylor. So hopefully those two on the outside combine with Crowder in the slot. That's going to make for a better, you know, a better trio of receivers for Darnold. They also brought in Frank Gore to lighten load on Le'Veon Bell, add some experience to the locker room as well. Hopefully that helps. And the Jets have a whole new offensive line, essentially. I mean, they could be starting five new guys in the trenches. Now, the most significant would be Mekhi Becton, rookie number 11, 11th overall pick. They also brought in Connor McGovern to hopefully cure their woes at center. So it'll be interesting to see what the Jets do with all these new pieces. They didn't add any wow skill players, but they upgraded all over the offense. So we shall see.
Good stuff. Now, off-season issues that we'll run into, obviously, the Jamal Adams trade request is kind of looming over things. How is that? How do you see that playing out? What are the effects that it might have on the team?
I mean, right now, I don't see why the Jets would trade him. They can control him for up to two more years, as many as four with the franchise tags. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, I understand why he wants to get paid. I understand why he wants to get paid now. But I also see it from the Jets' perspective. You know, they don't have much reason to. If he wants to sit and pout and not play, then that's what they should let him do. I wouldn't trade Jamal Adams, would you?
No.
Right. No. So now combine the fact that if they do, they really don't have much safety depth. You know, that weakens a defensive back room that they've significantly improved this year. If I was Adams, I would simply, you know, I would understand that not many guys get paid before their fourth year in the league, and I know that just happened with Myles Garrett, but Myles Garrett's an elite pass rusher.
Right. Let's look ahead to 2020 now. What's kind of the expectation for the team? What's your floor and ceiling, and how do you see them matching up with the Cardinals when they meet up in early in the season?
Well, I think as far as expectations go, you know, you can't go into the season thinking they're any better than the third best team in their division. Now, Bills are coming off a playoff run. They got better. Now, they've got a really young core that's always improving. And then, you know, just having watched the Jets and the Patriots my entire life, you expect New England and Belichick to work some sort of magic now that Cam Newton's in town. So I think it's kind of hard to say they're even a contender. If I had to bet, I would go with, you know, hoping for a 500 season, and I'd call that a good one for the Jets. You know, not finishing in last place behind a very young Dolphins team seems like that seems like the floor, which, you know, could very well be possible for them. As far as the Cardinals go, you know, I know they had a worse record last year. You know, they got a sophomore quarterback compared to a third-year quarterback in Darnold. I'd much rather be in the Cardinals' position. You know, Kingsbury and Murray look like a good match together, whereas Darnold and Gase do not. And, you know, you throw in the fact that now Murray has an elite number one receiver in Hopkins. That's something Darnold's never had. The Cardinals were already putting up more points than the Jets last season. Add him to the mix, and I think you have a much better team, or at least a team that's in going in a much better direction.
Awesome. So what do you think? If you had to guess what the Jets' record would be next year, what are you hoping for? And, well, what is your best kind of the best-case scenario, worst-case scenario?
Well, it's funny. As a Jets fan, like, I always joke with friends and family is, you know, never bet on the Jets to win a game. But I'm not gonna give you an 0-16 prediction. I would say worst case scenario is, you know, 6 wins, and best case scenario with the division and the schedule that they have to play this year, it's really hard for me to see them going more than 8-8, 500.
Well, that's a really close floor and ceiling, which is both encouraging and disappointing, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, if that's how you want to spin it.
Well, appreciate your time, Gary. Over now on Twitter, how can Cardinals fans interact with you? Obviously, it's your site for the network. Is it Jets Wire or the Jets Wire?
It is the Jets.
Okay,
the Jets Wire.
It yeah. goes between that with some of the sites. So thejetswire.com. It's one of the USA Today sites. And how can fans find you on Twitter?
I am at Gary H. Phillips on Twitter.
Thanks for your time, Gary. Appreciate it as always. Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We've moved on to the Cardinals' Week 6 opponent, the Dallas Cowboys, on Monday Night Football. We've got another opponent preview coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Next up in our season preview, going through each of the teams, the Cardinals' opponents this season are the Dallas Cowboys, And to help us with that, I have invited, and he has accepted graciously, Katie Drummond from CowboysWire.com, the NFL Wire site from our USA Today NFL Wire. And he is on, and he will talk to us about the Cowboys. Katie, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Jess. How are you, my man?
Doing fantastic. Now, KD's been covering the Cowboys for quite a while. How long have you been covering the Cowboys?
Since 2010. So I basically have done, actually mid-season 2010. So I've been, done the whole Jason Garrett regime, and this is going to be my first season with a new head coach for the Cowboys. Everything I've done has basically been since Jason Garrett took over mid-year for Wade Phillips.
So yeah, we've been covering about the same time. So let's look back on the Cowboys season last year. We'll kind of go from 2019 moving forward. We'll talk about the season, how it went compared to expectations, offseason gains and losses, things surrounding the team, and then kind of look ahead to 2020, the expectations there, as well as the that Monday night matchup that we're excited for. 2019, you guys didn't make the playoffs. It was close. How did 2019 go? What went well? What didn't go well? And, well, how did that go compared to expectations?
Well, it was definitely a disappointing season for the Cowboys. There's no way to cut it. Expectations were high based on, you know, winning the NFC East the year before. But one of the biggest challenges that they had was that Jason Garrett was a lame duck coach. A lot of people thought that despite you know, how the season ended, that he could have been fired. He could have been let go. He was entering the last year of his contract, but the Cowboys chose to keep him. And things just kind of seemed to spiral downhill from there. If you're not going to extend your coach, if you're not going to give him that vote of confidence, Jerry Jones believed, he even said that he thinks people that are working without a safety net of a future year do their best work. It had worked previously for the Cowboys. Jason Garrett, you know, had faced that scrutiny before and come through with flying colors in, I believe it was 2014. They went into the season without him having a contract, and that was the great year that ended up with disappointment, obviously, with the Dez caught it in Green Bay, but they were able to win a playoff game, get to the divisional round, and he basically wanted to capture that magic again. But things had gotten stale in Dallas. There was a lot of inconsistency, a lot of not knowing what was going on around the team. There was coaching, different coaches fighting with each other. There was something between the defense coordinator and the linebacker coach, where the linebacker coach ended up basically getting sat down. He wasn't officially suspended, but he was sat down for a couple games because of a conflict with the DC. There was players and not really doing what they wanted to do. And basically, the lame duck season infected the whole campaign. And despite Dak Prescott emerging as one of the better quarterbacks in the NFL in 2019, the whole ship was just kind of in a weird, rowing in multiple directions, and everybody was just ready for a change. It was one of those things where the coaching staff just kind of wore the team out. The message got stale, and pretty similar to what happened with the coach that is now in charge of the Cowboys, Mike McCarthy in Green Bay, where it, you know, a quality coach that had some skins on the wall, but it just didn't, things had gotten stale between him and the team, and it was just time for everybody to go in a different direction.
Let's talk about Mike McCarthy and hiring. What is your take on the addition of McCarthy and how he will change things up, and more importantly, the relationship between him and Dak Prescott, considering how things went between him and Aaron Rodgers towards the end of his stint there?
Yeah, I think you have to lean towards McCarthy being successful when you look at his entire tenure. He's an aggressive coach, which is, you know, all the rage in today's NFL. He goes for it on fourth down. He passes on first down. He does all of those things that are kind of the mark of a good offensive coach. And I think the way that he's going to institute his West Coast offense principles, the horizontal progressions, looking to move things sideline to sideline to take advantage of space, of the spacing of the defense, and putting that on top of what Kellen Moore was able to do early for the Cowboys. Now, for those who are intimately familiar with the Cowboys, they know that they opened up the season like gangbusters. Yes, the competition was bad. It was the Giants, the Redskins, and the Dolphins. But what they did on offense, the amount of motion, pre-snap motion that they used, the trickery, all of those sorts of things that fans have been begging for out of a Jason Garrett offense, Kellen Moore was able to put to the forefront in the first 3 weeks of the season. then they just started disappearing from the offense. So you had Rutsch, where the Cowboys offense just didn't look like they could do much of anything until they got behind in games. And it was just kind of just a hodgepodge of things. But there was a clear delineation between what the Cowboys did the first couple weeks of the season and how the offense looked the remaining parts of the season. The hope is that McCarthy, and he did retain Moore as his offense coordinator, and he's maintaining Moore's verbiage as far as how he calls the offense. Everything from the West Coast offense is now going to be put in the way that Kellen Moore and Dak Prescott communicate to keep that chemistry going and to interrupt the progress that they've made as little as possible. The hope is that the knowledge that McCarthy has, the West Coast principles, on top of the golden boy genius that everybody thinks Kellen Moore is as a future head coach in the league, combining all of that into one offense will give the Cowboys the opportunity to really blossom. And then the Cowboys went out and added to the weaponry that Dak Prescott has. They've completely changed over the wide receiver grouping that he has. His targets when he first came into the league were Dez Bryant and Jason Witten, and those were the primary targets. Terrence Williams was the number two. Now they have Amari Cooper and Michael Gallup that's ascending, and they went out and drafted CeeDee Lamb. Blake Jarwin has taken over for Jason Witten as a number one tight end. Ezekiel Elliott, Tony Pollard is a dynamic force, EPA monster. He is as efficient as they get breaking tackles, and he's a big play waiting to happen every time he touches the ball. So with all of these weapons at his disposal, you have the idea that the Cowboys offense should soar if you believe that the limitations that were placed are because of Jason Garrett. Removing him from the equation, replacing that with Mike McCarthy and his offensive mind, keeping Kellen Moore, all of that kind of puts into play the idea that the Cowboys should be a top 3 to 5 offense in the NFL. And you have to think that that's going to be the case considering, with the consideration that COVID-19 has completely evaporated the offseason for the Cowboys and them getting integrated with Mike McCarthy.
Yeah, you look at the weapons they have. There are few teams that you could even say are comparable across the board when you got the running back, you have the quarterback, you got the receivers, you've got the tight end. What's the offensive line looking like as moving forward? Is it what it was? Obviously, they've had to make some changes.
Yeah, they did have to make some changes. Travis Frederick retired in the offseason. He obviously missed 2018 with a game bear syndrome. It's an autoimmune deficiency that basically robs you of strength and feeling in your extremities. Very dangerous. They were thankful that he was able to bounce back and play it again in 2019. But even despite making the Pro Bowl, he was not the same player that he was before he went out with the injury. He cited the injury and his inability to play at the level that he was accustomed to as a reason that he retired. He just didn't want to go out there and be a shell of himself. So now there's going to be open competition for center, and there's also a competition at left guard. So we all know that Zach Martin, he's one of the best in the NFL. He has, I believe, 6 different all-pro nominations, like 4 first team, 2 second team, in his 6 years in the league. He's never not been on an all-pro team since he joined. Teron Smith is still one of the best left tackles in the game, if not the best. He has a couple injuries every year. He's played 13 games in a season, like 3 or 4 years in a row. So you know you're going to miss some time. You have to have a competent swing tackle. They lost Cam Fleming. They brought in Cam Irving. But the biggest question marks are going to be in the middle. And as everybody knows, pressure that starts on the middle is what is the most disruptive thing to a quarterback. A lot of attention is paid to the left tackle as being, you know, the blindside protector. But if you can't protect up the middle, you have an issue because it basically will cut your field in half when the quarterback has to scramble. Now, Prescott is great at scrambling and throwing on the run, so that's mitigated a bit, but you still need to have a good solution there. So they have Connor Williams, who was a 2018 second-round pick. They have Connor McGovern, who redshirted last year. He was a third-round pick. He played both center and guard at Penn State. And then this year they drafted Tyler Biadasz out of Wisconsin, who was entering the 2019 season seen as a first-round pick, but injuries kind of derailed his season. It limited his play. He played the season, but he was injured. He did not play up to his potential, and he had off-season surgery. So he's in the mix to play, as well as Joe Looney, who was the guy that took over for Frederick for the full 2018 season as a starter at center. So those four guys are kind of all in the mix to find two starters. And the Cowboys, there's a lot of pedigree there, but whether or not they can play up to the standard that's necessary to maintain the reputation of the Cowboys line. Now, a lot of people will talk about the Cowboys line. It is a dynamic run-blocking group. Pass protection, they're good, but they're not the best. There are several offensive lines that are better at pass protection than what the Cowboys offensive line has been. But run blocking, they're dominant. We like to see what they can do when, you know, when they're pushing forward instead of having to catch the defensive linemen that are trying to penetrate the pocket. But overall, I think that they're still going to have a great line. You can't go wrong when you have two all pros anchoring that and everybody else just kind of has to fill in. I haven't even talked about Lyle Collins, who really had one of the best right tackle seasons in the NFL last year. There's a handful of right tackles that are better than him, but he's definitely in the top five, and he ascended, making himself worthy of the contract that the Cowboys gave him, a five-year, $50 million contract they gave him entering 2019. So all in all, you can't really complain about the Cowboys offensive line. It's much better than what many other teams have at their disposal. I think they do get a bit overrated in the national media as far as how good they are, but they're still a very, very talented group.
Defensively, and you covered a whole bunch of stuff on the offensive side of the ball, and they look great there. Defensively, who have they gained? Who have they lost?
Well, there's a reason why I focus on the offense, because the defense isn't very good. We have to be honest about where the Cowboys stand as far as their defense. They have DeMarcus Lawrence, who is one of the best edge rushers in the league. He only had 5 sacks last year. He had shoulder surgery that took away his offseason, and he was double teamed at an alarming rate. And he was one of those guys where, if you look at like ESPN's metric, pass rush win rate, he's always at the top despite being double teamed. He just didn't get to the quarterback, and that happens. Sacks is an overrated stat. It's really about how much pressure you can put on, and how that basically dovetails into what the rest of your defensive line can do. If the entire defensive line is quality, then everybody's going to get sacks. But last year, the Cowboys didn't really have the push up the middle that they were looking for, which is why they kind of revamped that defensive front. But all in all, DeMarcus Lawrence is the star. They lost Byron Jones, who was basically everything that you would ever want in a cornerback, except he never got turnovers. He had, you know, one turnover in his career with a jump ball into the end zone a couple years ago. For some reason, this dude just was allergic to getting turnovers for the team. That's very important with the new staff, which is why they did not re-sign him. But you saw the contract that Miami gave him. Everybody in the league thought that Byron Jones was one of the best corners out there. He was definitely the best one on the free agent market, so he got big money elsewhere. The team did address those defensive line deficiencies. They went out and they signed Gerald McCoy to play 3-tech. They signed Dontari Poe to play the nose tackle position. They're going to be getting back Tyrone Crawford. I think the loss of him to injury early in the year, he had hip surgeries on both hips. The loss of him to injury, he is the defensive front leader. And I think that's kind of why things fell apart for the defense last year. Sean Lee is aging. You lost Leighton Vander Esch. He played half of the season. He was out with a neck injury. He had a surgery over the offseason. But I went back and checked the film. Vander Esch seemed to get injured in the very first week of the season. So after having an all-pro level rookie season, he completely fell off in his play. But I think it was related to the injury, and then he just wasn't able to maintain with the hurt throughout the season and finally called it quits around mid-year. Jalen Smith, great guy. Sketchy in coverage. I think they're going to do some different things with him. They have designated with, well, they've declared him a designated pass rusher, which means that he's basically going to be in a mixture of a 30 and 40 front, the outside linebacker in what would be a 30 front, but they're going to use him in a variety of ways with 5-man fronts and things of that sort. So that's going to be very exciting because he is a dynamic pass rusher at the linebacker position. His issue is in coverage and being able to fall back. You know, he had the devastating knee injury coming out of Notre Dame. He redshirted his rookie year, and then was slow to come around in his second year, and then he exploded, and then last year was a bit of a regression. So we'll see what they can do. They have to get him out of the middle. He can't be the middle linebacker with his deficiencies in running, so I'm very interested to see how they deploy him. But the secondary is an absolute mess. They lost Byron Jones. They brought back Anthony Brown, who was in the doghouse under old DC Chris Richard. Chidobe Awuzie is now the number one corner, but he's even worse at locating the ball than Byron Jones. At least Byron Jones locks people down. Highlight after highlight is made on Awuzie because he has sticky coverage, but he has absolutely zero ball awareness. And every week, whoever the quarterback is has at least 2 highlight plays where the announcer says, "I can't believe he stuck it in that window," but it's the same guy every week that they're sticking in the window on. So you kind of got to say that it's a cornerback. That's the issue. So he's a big issue. They drafted Diggs out of Alabama in the second round to compete. They signed Dale Worley out of the Raiders camp to be a starter at cornerback, so he's interesting. But for my money, I love a couple guys. Xavier Woods, who is the incumbent safety. I think he's just itching to become a Pro Bowl player. And then a fourth round pick, Reggie Robinson out of Tulsa. He just ascended in his last year in school. And he is a dynamic playmaker, turnover machine. I really look those guys to make a big impact. And of course, they did sign HaHa Clinton Dix, who was drafted by McCarthy in Green Bay, to be the other safety opposite of Xavier Woods. So they finally got rid of Jeff Heath. He was a major problem in coverage and in angle when it comes to breaking down and making a tackle. So they got rid of him. They've improved there. So there's a lot of chance for improvement, but it just hasn't been a good unit. And it's really been the detriment of the Cowboys for the entire time that Rod Marinelli was in charge of the defense. They've never put a good defense on the field, except for 2016, where the team was basically playing keep away with Zeke Elliott. They just kept the defense off the field, so they had good numbers. But they've never been a dynamic defense, and that's been the Achilles heel of the Cowboys franchise for several years.
So what can you expect from them in 2020? What's kind of the hope? From what it sounds like, on the high end, they could be a Super Bowl contender. What's their floor? What's their ceiling? And what are you looking forward to in that Week 6 Monday Night Football matchup?
Yeah, the biggest thing about the Cowboys is the change in leadership and how the offseason has affected them. If you're in a vacuum, I'd say that Mike McCarthy's Super Bowl pedigree first year with a team would be worth two wins. I'd then turn around and say that getting rid of Jason Garrett and the decision he made, you got to remember, Jason Garrett kept a kicker that missed 10 field goals until like the last 4 weeks of the season when they signed Kai Forbath. It was just unconscionable that they let Brett Maher continue kicking simply because he had a big leg. So they completely screwed that up. The decision-making end game was horrible, and the missed kicks tangibly lost them games. There were two games that they lost that they missed kicks in, and then you also saw just a complete downtroddenness of the sideline whenever he would miss a kick, and the team would go in the tank. So I think that Jason Garrett cost them two wins. McCarthy would have added two wins. That's a 12-4 team. Pencil them in as Super Bowl contenders. But then COVID hit. And Mike McCarthy hasn't been able to work with any of the guys. They haven't been able to meet in person. How do you implement a new culture and a new regime and new practice habits if you can't even meet your players, if you can't go into the locker room and gauge who the actual leaders of the team are to know who you need to work with? It's been a really weird offseason. I think a lot of NFL teams are going to deal with that, but teams that have a new coach are really, really in a bind when it comes to trying to make that transition. Can Mike McCarthy be that guy to overcome all of that? Sure, but if he doesn't, I'll be like, yeah, I kind of understand why it was so difficult for them to turn around. I think they're a 10-win team regardless. I think the Eagles have a leg up because they kept their coach, because they have the Doug Peterson system in place, and they could take time off and come back and just, oh yeah, we did this last year, we did this the year before, and it's not new to anybody. So I think that gives them a bit of a leg up in that regard. I would say the Cowboys are more talented, but because of the coaching continuity, I would probably give the Eagles a leg up when all is said and done in the division. I think the Cowboys are capable of winning the division, but they're most likely going to be a wild card team to play it safe. But once they get in, if things kind of work out as the season goes along, I could easily see them being still Super Bowl contenders, even if they're coming from the wild card spot. Now, you kind of got to have the number one seed now that they're changed the rules. The number two seed doesn't even get a bye week anymore. So they've really put the perks as far as, you know, the playoff bye with the number one seed. If you don't win the conference, it's going to be really difficult to make a Super Bowl now with the rule changes of adding the seventh playoff team. But I think the Cowboys have the talent to do it. As far as a Cardinals matchup, man, I can't wait to see Kyler Murray. That dude is so phenomenal to me. I can't wait to see the progression that he makes from 1 year to his sophomore season with the Kingsbury offense. So I'm very excited about what you guys have done. DeAndre Hopkins has been a thorn in the Cowboys side. I still don't know who's going to check him. And then you have Larry Fitzgerald as a number two. How in the world can you even call Larry Fitzgerald a number two wide receiver? That's insane to me. So I'm really excited to see what the Cardinals offense looks like. I think it's going to be one of those situations where the time and the schedule that the two teams meet, being in mid-October, I think all the kinks will be worked out by then, and teams will really be flowing into who their personality is. And I think it's going to be a great matchup. You guys have a ridiculously difficult division, so the talent might not match your record, but I think the Cardinals are going to be a formidable opponent for the Cowboys when they meet.
I'm excited for the matchup, and I'll tell you something I said that the Cowboys kind of missed out on when it came to Jason Garrett. I I think had they had Jerry Jones been willing to cut bait with Garrett a year earlier, Cliff Kingsbury would have been perfect for that team.
100%. Yep.
Perfect for that team, because if there's one thing, you know, and I think, well, one, the Texas tie is one. Two is the fact that Kingsbury came in coming out of college and didn't enter the league with the same sort of ego that a guy like Chip Kelly or Nick Saban would come into the league for. And I think that's really benefited him. They had the offensive skill players already. From the time the Cardinals hired him, and looking at what Dallas did last year, I think they really missed out on the potential of Dak Prescott. And well, then if he'd have gotten CeeDee Lamb, he'd have loved CeeDee Lamb. Ezekiel Elliott having all those offensive weapons would have been probably something special last year, even in that first year.
Yeah. Yeah, I tend to agree with you. Mike McCarthy was high, very high on my list. He was. I did a potential Garrett replacement power ranking every week from week 14 on of the season, because you knew that he was gone. So I went and I handicapped all of the coaches that were out there. Mike McCarthy was always near the top of my list. If they could have traded for Sean Payton or Bill Belichick, those were my one and two. But outside of that, there were three or four names that I said, if they make any of these hires, I'm ecstatic. Mike McCarthy was one of them. A lot of Cowboys fans really weren't keen on McCarthy until his name started being mentioned by the team as a potential fit. So there's going to be a lot of people that are ready to pounce on him if things don't go smoothly out of the gate. But yeah, there were plenty of opportunities for them to have gone in a different direction if they had made the move a year prior. They would have probably had a coach that was more they would have known more about how to approach the Dak Prescott contract situation. We all know that they just passed the deadline without being able to agree to a long-term deal. So he's going to play out the year on a franchise tag. Only two other quarterbacks have done that. They both since left their teams without a long-term deal. That was Drew Brees in San Diego and Kirk Cousins in Washington. So the precedent isn't looking good for the Cowboys and Dak Prescott to have a long-term relationship. And I think if they didn't drag their heels with firing Jason Garrett, they would have known whether or not they could say, yes, let's definitely commit. Let's give him the Brinks truck. Let's open up the bank for Prescott, because we know he works with our head coach. I think the lack of knowledge of how he will work in Mike McCarthy's system played some role in them not going to the extreme that almost every team has to go to when their franchise quarterback is up for a new contract. Mm-hmm. I think that played a role in it.
All right. Well, Katie, thank you so much for your time. Cardinals fans, those who are listening, you can find him on CowboysWire.com. It's the CowboysWire.USAToday.com. And you can find KD on Twitter at KD Drummond NFL. And you can interact with him and on don't troll him. He does like the Cowboys. We know we don't like the Cowboys here, but he's a good guy. He'd cut his great coverage. And I appreciate the time. Appreciate it as always. Coming up next on the Rise Up Secret Podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We move to the next opponent for the Cardinals in Week 7, their last game before the bye. They come back home to take on the Seattle Seahawks. That's coming up next on Rise Up Secret. We're back on the Rise Up Secret Podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We move on to talk about the Seattle Seahawks, a team the Cardinals will play twice. They play early in the season. In the first half of the season, they'll play in Week 7. Then turn around and play again in Week 11. To help us preview what we can expect or what the Seahawks did in the offseason, to know more about them, I have invited one of the contributors from SeahawksWire.com, the USA Today NFL Wire site that covers the Seahawks, just like Hardswire is the USA Today NFL Wire site for the Cardinals, Cole Musgrove. Cole, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Doing well, thanks for coming onto the show. Tell us, let's start back at the beginning. We'll talk about the season that passed. We'll talk about the offseason more. So the Seahawks, they are seemingly good every year. We hate that. What went well for them? What didn't go well? And if anything, and how did their performance last season match up with the expectations that they had?
Well, you know, last year Seahawks finished 11-5, which is actually their most wins, believe it or not, since the 2014 season. Handful of 10-6 seasons in between then and this past season. But unfortunately, kind of fell apart late with some cluster injuries, especially the running back position. I mean, we lost two running backs against the Cardinals in week 16 last year at home. Started 10-2, but then finished 1-3, unfortunately. But they did win the first playoff game since 2016, a nice 17-9 win over the Eagles, but ultimately fell short against the Packers in the divisional round.
What were the things that where did you see the team do well? What were the struggles? You mentioned the running back injuries. But if you're looking at the highs and the lows, what went well? What were the struggles that happened down the stretch?
So certainly what went well is Russell Wilson put forth yet another MVP caliber season. It's clear the guy is in his prime, and many believe he should have, you know, even received a single MVP vote last year. I know Lamar Jackson kind of ran away with it quite literally at the end. But, you know, up in the first half of the season, I mean, there was no stopping Russell Wilson. The ground game was also pretty great until, of course, the cluster injuries late. So those certainly were things that were great. Certainly the things the Seahawks can build on going forward. You know, if you have a top five quarterback like in Russell Wilson, you know, your offense is going to look pretty good even if you are a run-first team. Unfortunately, what didn't go well is the secondary – has been kind of quietly Seattle's Achilles heel these last two seasons. It's really unlike a Pete Carroll-led defense to be so leaky, especially in his area of expertise. So it's, you know, that turned out, especially got exposed against the Packers. And then certainly what everyone noticed was pretty weak was the pass rush. I mean, they only had 28 sacks last year as a team. I mean, the leading sack artist was Rasheem Green with only four. So certainly defense was a major liability for the Seahawks and ultimately led to their downfall.
As we move to the offseason, in free agency first, who are the key impact? Who are the main guys that are not returning or appear not to be returning? Well, obviously, Jadeveon Clowney is kind of up in the air still. Though it looks like that ship might have sailed.
Well, it's certainly there is a lot of question mark with Clowney going on right now. But with the, you know, the coronavirus pandemic and NFL teams not allowed to bring players in, a lot of mystery still. I know the Titans, there's still room in the Titans, even after they just extended, you know, Derrick Henry. But even there, the general manager just still says he wants to bring in Clowney for a visit. So, I mean, the only team that knows his body as well as he does is Seattle. But in terms of, like, what we have actually lost, that, you know, clear, they're gone. We've lost some pretty critical linemen. We lost DJ Fluker. He's been one of the better guards we've had. Longtime center Justin Britt and kind of a close personal friend of Wilson as well. Both have gone. And then George Fant left. And I know he wasn't certainly, star player, but he certainly, you know, had impact on that offensive line.
And who are the guys who have been added that will be impactful this year? Well, how would they address those holes that they now have, and who were their big pickups in free agency?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the Seahawks feel real good about his third-round pick, Damian Lewis. He's a guard. He's pretty versatile. He's played center, guard, right tackle, left tackle. He's, you know, played, you know, he's kind of a Swiss Army knife of the offensive line. So I know I feel like that, you know, acquiring him makes losing – you know, a DJ Fluker, you know, a little more stomachable for the Seahawks. They feel like they've got kind of his replacement already getting in the wings. As far as, you know, offensive, you know, free agent signing, they signed Greg Olsen from the Panthers. What's great about Olsen is, you know, we still think he has a little bit of gas left in the tank. Him to be the 2015 version of himself. We just need him to be, you know, solid couple, three catches, you know, two, three catches a game, move the chains, be a force in the red zone, at least until Will Disley gets back up and running full speed. Also signed Philip Dorsett from the Patriots. So a little deep threat action going, some to pair up with Lockett and DK Metcalf.
And he's expected to be the competition's open between him and David Moore to kind of take over that number three wide out.
Yeah, something to bolster up, you know, hopefully hoping for a little more consistency in that product, you know,
The tight end game is strong in Seattle. Obviously, Will Disley be coming back. Is Hollister back on the roster as well?
Yeah, and then they re-signed Luke Wilson as well.
So Wilson has been a long timer. Hollister was real productive down the stretch. Greg Olson's fantastic. As I was in the series I've been doing, I kind of do some of the rankings. I went through the receivers, and Seattle has a really good top pair of receivers, and that number three is kind of we'll see. But you don't really need it when you got the tight ends that they do. When you can run Disley and Olson out there, or Hollister and Olson, and get major production, that's something that they probably, from top to bottom, have the strongest tight end room in the division. Now, obviously, George Kittle is the class of the NFL. Sure. But the, right there behind them, you've got your trio between Disley and Olson, and that's a really good group of tight ends there. Now, other than that, so they've got the additions. Any other you mentioned Damian Lewis? Who are the draft picks that you see contributing this year?
Well, first and foremost, their number one pick, Jordan Brooks, linebacker. Certainly, the Seahawks are no strangers to having the unconventional first-round pick, much to the chagrin of a lot of Seahawks fans out there. But people see him as kind of like the next Bobby Wagner in some sorts. He's incredibly athletic, incredibly productive, had a great career at Texas Tech. So certainly, the Seahawks say KJ Wright's still in their plans, and all signs seem to indicate that way, but he is certainly getting older, and having perhaps a replacement or swing guy come in like him, that's going to be huge.
That will be indeed. Any other issues or concerns that have entered the off seasons other than personnel this off season?
Quite frankly, other than of course the coronavirus pandemic, that's
everywhere.
It goes for everybody. In terms of personnel. I like what the Seahawks have done, especially during the pass rush. I mean, I know they haven't had the splashiest signings, but adding Bruce Irvin and Benson Mayoa really will go a long way to shore up a shaky defensive line. I mean, the two of them had 15 and a half sacks combined. I mean, that counts for over half of what Seattle produced last year.
Indeed. Now, there's the story that doesn't keep it, it won't go away, and that's Antonio Brown. Antonio Brown and a possible connection with the Seahawks. Wouldn't that be great?
Oh, that would be something. I know.
It would give you guys the best trio of wide receivers in the NFC West. Because with Hopkins and Fitzgerald and Kirk, I think the Cardinals have the best trio overall. But you put Antonio Brown with Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf. Wow.
It certainly is tempting. There's no secret that Russell Wilson definitely would want something like that. I just don't see it happening from the Seahawks perspective. I mean, we're not even two or three years removed from purging the locker room of notable malcontents, Richard Sherman, Michael Bennett. The last thing I think the Seahawks want is to bring in another guy who could potentially be a major headache. This guy was getting 160 targets a year in Pittsburgh and still got upset that he wasn't getting enough and had to split with Schuster. So I can't imagine how he would feel getting split three ways between him, Lockett, and Metcalf, and it'd be a run-first offense. So, I mean, I know he's trying to do some little image rehab, but the guy's a headache. I don't know if it's going to put it mildly.
Yes, he is, but when he's on, that guy can ball. Now, The two-headed running attack, Chris Carson returns. You got Carlos Hyde. Rashad Penny's not going to be back for a while. What does that running attack, the rushing attack, look like entering this year?
I think it looks like it's, going to be right back to where it was. By all accounts, Chris Carson looks like he's on track, rehabbing well, no setbacks reportedly coming out of that. If that's, if he's back to where he was and Carlos Hyde is another 1,000-yard rusher, Seahawks could have another lethal ground attack, which only helps Wilson in the play action game.
In looking ahead to this season, what are your expectations of Seattle in terms of their floor and ceiling, best case, worst case? How do you see them performing this coming season in terms of wins and losses?
Well, if all things go right, I know with no weird cluster injuries and assuming Russell Wilson is performing at his normal level, I see 11 to 12 wins being their ceiling. That certainly seems within the ballpark. I mean, they were 10 and 2 last year. Arizona, I know they're upcoming, but with San Francisco coming off a Super Bowl loss and the Rams looking like they're kind of starting to rebuild, the division's certainly in play for the Seahawks. And with expanded playoff field, then playoffs should be the expectation. As far as basic, I mean, with a franchise caliber quarterback like Wilson, I can't imagine the Seahawks, you know, barring something catastrophic, losing more than 8 games. So 8-8, 9-7 is probably the basement for this team. But I just think, you know, all healthy with the quarterback, coach, they're still going to be in it, in the mix at the end of the season.
Are we ever going to get out of this rut of the Cardinals beating Seattle in Seattle and Seattle beating Arizona in Arizona? Because I haven't seen a win, like the Cardinals haven't beat them in our home stadium since Russell Wilson's debut in 2012.
I remember that game.
And we have some wacky ability to beat Seattle in Seattle, unlike any other team in the league.
I don't get it. It makes absolutely no sense. We go to Glendale and we win often convincingly. I know there was that weird fluke tie, but it usually, you know,
neither team really wanted to win that game. That was stupid.
No. They were trying their best to lose it, and neither of them did. But, you know, for whatever reason, when the Cardinals come up here, we suddenly don't even know how to pick up first downs. And it no matter how good or how bad the Cardinals have been, it, you know, you guys have won 5 out of the last 7 meetings. And actually, I remember last year I wrote an article about top 5 Seattle rivals, and you wrote a rebuttal saying it was a little disrespectful. It didn't have the Cardinals involved. So maybe I got to add them to at least an honorable mention here.
The Cardinals would be at least competitive for them to be a real, real rival for the Hawks. But the whole division is fun in that sense. Is whoever's good is a rival. But
And it's so crazy, you know, coming from a Seahawks fan perspective, you know, it's so frustrating watching, you know, during the Patriots of the Brady years, that whole division, and it's not the reason they were good, but their division was so dysfunctional. Often because of the Patriots. But whereas the Seahawks, we've been pretty great this last decade, but every year a new NFC West team rises top and is the new hot thing in the NFL. Last year was the Niners, and then it was the Rams. In 2015, the Cardinals had a really great year. And it's so frustrating that there's always that other NFC West team.
Right. Well, how do you see it playing out? Do you like the matchup this year? I'm not saying predict scores or anything, but how do you think the two teams match up this year? Arizona's got an improved offense. If you want to look at the beginning of the season, Kenyon Drake was so much better than David Johnson, and now he's going to be there for a full season. You've got the receiving core. How's that going to match up against the Seattle defense? Is there going to be and then flip-flop the other side, Arizona's defense, which hopes to be improved against an offense which is run and tight end heavy?
Well, I tell you what, when I saw the update that the Cardinals acquired DeAndre Hopkins for, you know, a McDonald's coupon from the Texans, my heart just sunk. I got PTSD from when, you know, he visited the Seahawks as the Texans a couple years ago and had like 200 yards receiving. And that was with, you know, Richard Sherman, Cam Chancellor, Earl Thomas, Michael, you know, the old school Legion of Boom. And he just absolutely torched us. So now I'm thinking, oh boy, he's going against a considerably more questionable secondary, you know, with two other really capable receivers and a quarterback who looks pretty promising. You know, I think the Cardinals offense is going to have some real success, especially if Quentin Dunbar, our big secondary acquisition from the Washington team, I mean, that is a whole other can of worms. And I mean, they're going to have to make some kind of move, I think, to get a defender, because I don't know if he will play. I mean, I don't want to get too into the weeds because I'm not a legal expert by any means, but it's a interesting situation to say the least.
All right. We appreciate your time, Colb, talking Seahawks, kind of talking Seahawks Cardinals, giving us the lowdown for what's happened with the offseason. Listeners, you can find his work on SeahawksWire.com, SeahawksWire.USAToday.com. And if you want to interact with him on Twitter, you can find him at Cole with a K _Musgrove. On Twitter as well. Cole, I appreciate the time. Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We'll be back to talk about the Miami Dolphins, their eighth opponent of the season, and their first after their Week 8 bye. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web, and we're moving on to a new segment of another Cardinals opponent in the 2020 season. We're going to focus on the Miami Dolphins, their Week 9 opponent, their Week 9 opponent after their bye week. And to help us kind of get to know the Dolphins and what they've gone through the last year and looking forward to what they're expected for this year, I've invited Kyle Krabs from our sister site, Dolphins Wire, the NFL Wire site covering the Miami Dolphins. Dolphins Wire's managing editor, Kyle Krabs, is with me. Kyle, thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for your time. And how's everything going out there?
It's going great. Thank you, Jess. And it's always a pleasure to get together and talk ball. And looking forward to a dynamic with two teams that only see each other once every 4 years, unless, you know, maybe we get lucky, we play in the postseason sometime. That'd be pretty fun. But
it would have been fun for the notion of a Kyler Murray versus Josh Rosen Super Bowl, although we know that that's, you know, now that they've got Tua, that's probably never going to be the case.
No, it will not. Needless to say.
So let's take it back to 2019. Sure. Obviously, the Dolphins had a first-year head coach in Brian Flores. Things started very badly and got a little better as the year went on. Sort of what were expectations going into last season? What went well? What didn't go so well? And how did the Brian Flores regime play out? Because for me, it looked almost a lot like the 2018 Cardinals with Steve Wilks, only the Dolphins decided to roll with him at least another year.
So entering into the 2019 offseason, when the Dolphins decided to make the regime change and fire Adam Gase, and they relieved Mike Tannenbaum from his duties as executive vice president of football operations for the team, everyone kind of knew that it was going to be a tough year. And the Dolphins deciding to hire Brian Flores, and Brian Flores coming off of that Super Bowl win for the New England Patriots, the Dolphins were the last team to hire assistants. And that's why, you know, we get to the end of the 2019 season and Brian Flores has two coordinator changes, and he fired his offensive line coach 2 weeks into training camp. You could kind of tell that the deck was stacked like all the way across the board from the coaches that were available for him to hire to be assistants, and the Dolphins just shedding bad contracts as much as they possibly could, kind of adopting almost like an NBA-style approach where they were willing to pay money to offload players for low-value picks just to get the contracts off the books, because contracts like Robert Quinn, who they ate a $1 million roster bonus on the third day of the 2019 calendar year for the league just to trade him for a seventh or sixth round pick to the Dallas Cowboys. And Ryan Tannehill, they ate $5 million of his 2019 salary just to trade him for a fourth round pick. And it was really based on the way Mike Tannenbaum ran the team and was consistently restructuring contracts to push off and defer guaranteed money, and then sign other big-name contracts because they always felt they were one or two players away. Well, that was the polar opposite of what you saw the Dolphins do this year, where they offloaded all these bad contracts. And then you get to the final couple days before the start of the season, and they trade Laremy Tunsil for two ones and a two, and then they trade Minkah Fitzpatrick after week two. And there was just a lot of change to begin with. And then there was a loss of perhaps the Dolphins' best player on the offensive and defensive side of the ball within the first 2 weeks of the season. And that's why you see the Dolphins start the year 0-7 and the tank for Tua narrative. But the team finished the year 5-4 over their final nine football games. And they really seem to, with Ryan Fitzpatrick as the quarterback, kind of energizing that team. And Brian Flores was very aggressive with his coaching mentality. So if I look for positives from a 5-11 campaign that resulted in the number five overall pick in the 2020 NFL draft, it was the fact that there were several players, Devontae Parker being one of them, Mike Gesicki being another key notable player, Eric Rowe on the defensive side of the football, players who had struggled to live up to their billing as high-value draft selections, who under the play of Brian Flores were able to evolve and level up their style of play. And then from a coaching perspective, Brian Flores Very aggressive. He was willing a lot of trick plays, surprise onside kicks, fake field goals, and willing to go for it on fourth down, which was a breath of fresh air, knowing that you're working with the deck stacked against you from a talent perspective because the team just desperately had to hit the reset button.
A player familiar to Cardinals fans, obviously the Dolphins acquired Josh Rosen in the mm-hmm. deal to, you know, the Cardinals needed to unload him. Steve Keim, you know, didn't want to, but ultimately have to after getting Kyler Murray. What was the Josh Rosen experience in 2019? In 2018, it felt like the narrative around him is he didn't do well, but look at that supporting cast. It was as bad as it possibly could have been. And thus far in two seasons, we know that there's talent, but we've seen very little proof on the field that he's going to turn out to be anything. What was the take on Rosen last year? I know that Brian Flores was basically made him work and change to even have a chance at starting, and then took it away from him.
Yeah, so one of the interesting dynamics here was offensive coordinator Chad O'Shea and the offense that he brought from New England to Miami when he came with Flores this past offseason. And Rosen gets into camp and his thought process is slow, and they're asking him to do a lot of setting of protections at the line of scrimmage and making checks and option routes. And that's a lot for a young quarterback to be able to process and handle. And it really felt like Rosen, from a physical perspective, I thought he had more zip on his ball than Ryan Fitzpatrick did. He was more fluid in the pocket than Ryan Fitzpatrick was. But because he had to think so much before and after the snap, everything was late. Everything from a throwing delivery often felt rushed. He was under a lot of pressure. He was sacked on, I believe, 10% of his dropbacks in the three games that he started for the Dolphins. And the real shame of it is after Chad O'Shea was relieved of his duties as the offensive coordinator at the end of the year, some of the stories that were coming out were saying, Chad O'Shea is telling Brian Flores the players can't learn the playbook. And then the players are telling Brian Flores, well, the playbook's entirely too complicated. We have like eight new starters on the offensive side of the football, including a young quarterback who started three games in Josh Rosen. And the supporting cast was awful. The offensive line was the worst in football. But it really felt like the mental side of the game was what really bogged him down and didn't give him a chance, and that there were so many layers. And Chad O'Shea was trying to teach the same offense the Patriots with Josh McDaniels and Tom Brady have been working with for over a decade together on. And it was just too much information overload on him. And that's why you saw the Dolphins go with a much more simplified kind of modern spread offense under Chan Gailey, who uses a lot of quick game and 11 personnel. It'd be interesting because Rosen would probably be set up for more success in this kind of offense, but he's never going to get a chance to play now because they've taken another quarterback.
Correct. So let's fast forward to the offseason. We know that the Cardinals acquired Kenyon Drake, so that was a midseason, and we're very glad for mm-hmm. that because Kenyon Drake proved to be and unfortunately for as Dolphins fans are for sure very aware, it was yet another player that they see flourish elsewhere. Ryan Tannehill, Jordan Phillips with the Bills, Kenyon Drake. Mm-hmm. It's just the list of players who leaves Miami and flourishes is I'm sure kind of frustrating. But who are some impact losses, if there are any impact losses left in the offseason, and how will that affect the team? And then Miami went out and spent some money. Who are their big additions that they're gonna see in the lineup?
Yeah, the nice thing about offloading so much talent in 2019 is there was really no one left to lose by the time the 2020 offseason rolled around. And you mentioned Kenyon Drake, and Drake just kind of felt like there was a glass ceiling in Miami that, again, the style of play that the Dolphins offense is now going to run, which is going to have a lot of the same spacing components of Arizona under Cliff Kingsbury, probably would have been a better environment for success. But again, Chad O'Shea's running a lot of two tight end sets and just wasn't meant to be. But as far as this offseason and personnel changes for Miami, signing Byron Jones to a, you know, for a very short amount of time, record-setting annual average salary contract for the corner position before the Eagles traded for Darius Slay and gave him a record-setting deal like a week later. Kyle Van Noy coming over from the New England Patriots in that defense, and he had his best career year under Brian Flores in 2018. They spent really heavy on the defensive side of the football. They did give offensive guard Eric Flowers, who had more success inside at guard than he did at tackle as a former number or top 10 overall pick. But he's about probably going to be an average starting guard, and they gave him, you know, $10 million per year on a three-year $30 million deal. But Shaq Lawson from the Buffalo Bills to come in and be a starting defensive end for them, and Elandon Roberts as another linebacker who had a career year under Brian Flores in 2018. And it's pretty telling. You look at the Dolphins' last three seasons, 2017, 18, and 19, and each of those three consecutive seasons are among the six worst points allowed seasons in franchise history. So the defense has been going way the wrong way. And to Brian Flores' credit, the Dolphins' defense in 2019 gave up 100 points in their first two games, and then they really settled down, and it was a much more successful campaign over the final 14 games once kind of they got over the hump of so much change so quickly before the start of the season. But I'm really excited about the defensive personnel with Byron Jones and Kyle Van Noy and Shaq Lawson and Emmanuel Ogba coming over from the Kansas City Chiefs, who was having a career year before he got hurt. Defense is going to look completely different, and it has a very New England Patriots style feel to it, whilst also still having the ability to go odd or even front, which from a week-to-week basis, that was one thing we saw the Dolphins try to do last year, is play schemed and get opponents out of their strengths based on the alignments and formations and strategies that they tried to implement on a week-to-week basis. They just didn't have the talent to pull it off.
Offensively, now, if I'm correct, Matt Breida was traded to Miami. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
so that's a very, you know, if you're looking at, that's a Kenyon Drake type runner. If he stays healthy, he does the same sort of thing. He's super productive. That's going to be a big boost to the running game.
Yeah, they signed Jordan Howard in free agency as well. So they kind of have this thunder and lightning dynamic about them. One of the things that, you know, is kind of apparent between the offensive coordinator that they chose to bring in Chan Gailey and his history with 11 personnel and spacing the field between his last two stops in Buffalo and the New York Jets, and the quarterback that they ultimately drafted in the draft in Tua Tagovailoa, they're really honestly shaping up to try to replicate a lot of the same play style as what you saw at Alabama, in which they're going to run downhill at you. They're going to challenge you physically with a ton of RPO concepts. Brian Flores, as the season went on, that offense got very much away from the traditional drop-back passing and evolved throughout the season to at the end of the year when they beat New England in New England week 17, a lot of RPO-style concepts. And they're going to look to run heavy at you downhill. If you stuff the box, okay, then we're going to zip it out into the flats, or we're going to throw quick slants on you. And if you stretch the field because we're nickel and diming you on the perimeter, then we're going to run into thin boxes. And Matt Breida is the change of pace back and the receiving back. It's kind of a fun dynamic between those two guys and what that could look like when you consider the reinforcements that they ultimately made on the offensive line as well, if that chemistry gets there.
In the draft, two always obviously is the big prize. There was some misdirection there leading up to draft. How convinced were you, or were you ever convinced otherwise that Miami might go other than a quarterback? I never was convinced. I thought the situation they were in, they had to go quarterback, and that Tua was always going to be their guy. And I even thought that they were going to trade up to number three to make sure they got him. Ultimately, Detroit got their guy. Miami got their guy. Was there really any truth to them thinking about going any other direction?
Yeah, I certainly think that the Dolphins did their due diligence to explore all options and be prepared for anything. But ahead of the 2019 season, one of the things that was talked about, mainly with owner Stephen Ross, is we want to rebuild and we want to position ourselves to secure a quarterback in the future and a franchise quarterback. So the kind of the writing was on the wall there. And It got a little interesting in which the Dolphins were playing the smokescreen game and teasing their interest in Justin Herbert and saying, well, maybe we'll go somebody else at five if we can't get the guy that we want and take Jordan Love later in the draft. And it really just kind of came down to these mind games of trying to whether it was the Chargers at six that they were worried about or the Carolina Panthers at seven, but just kind of put that vibe off there that there was no certainty that a team should or could be making a move to get up in front of Miami for the quarterback that they want.
Now, moving into 2020, how long do you think, how long will it be before Tua takes the field? Are they going to really try to freshman? Are they going to try to redshirt him this year and ride with Ryan Fitzpatrick? What do you think that season will look like? Fitzpatrick, a fine quarterback, volatile play. He's the perfect quarterback to have on a team that's not, I know if you have him starting, you're going to be exciting and you're probably not going to be very good. And is right. What we've seen from Ryan Fitzpatrick. But how long do you think Fitzpatrick will be starting?
It's interesting because of Ryan Fitzpatrick's career as a journeyman, his most starting experience, he has 5 years of starting experience under Chan Gailey, the offensive coordinator who's now here in Miami. So on a very surface level, it feels like between the year of sweat equity in which Ryan Fitzpatrick really energized the rest of this kind of island of misfit toys that the Dolphins were operating with in 2019 and got a 12,000-yard season or a 1,200-yard season out of Devontae Parker and got Mike Gesicki up over 650 receiving yards or whatever it was. The coaching staff really liked his energy and his leadership style. But as the talent, and this seems like it's always the case with Fitzpatrick, as the talent around him gets better, it becomes more apparent what his limitations are as a player. So I expect you will see Fitz start the season. And if the Dolphins get off to a tough start, and I kind of look at this schedule for them, and I can see them being 1-4, 2-5, kind of the first half of the season before they kind of get into some of the divisional games. They play the Jets in back-to-back weeks, I believe right after Arizona. But they got to go to San Francisco. They got Seattle coming to Miami. They got to go to Denver, to Arizona. So they got a lot of tough travel trips on their plate here in the first half of the season. I would expect, provided the offensive line shows some level of stability, by the midseason point, we probably should see Tua as the starting quarterback, because from all the reports that are coming out of South Florida, the Dolphins have no intention of just giving him the straight-up redshirt season in which he's not going to be in consideration to play at all.
So now, the 2020 season outlook. What do you see their floor being and their ceiling? I personally think that if things go well, this is a sneaky team, a sneaky okay team in that division. Now, things are complicated with Cam Newton in New England, but I see Miami as surprising some teams, especially with the revamped defense, a better offensive scheme, some more talent there on offense, that they might be better than advertised. But what do you see as their floor and ceiling in terms of win, and how do you think they match up against the Cardinals this year?
Yeah, I think the Dolphins' expectation should be an improved win-loss season or win-loss record versus last season. I think the floor is 6 wins. As far as you said, they made massive investments on the defensive side of the football, and they're getting Xavien Howard, who led NFL in 2018 in interceptions, back from a knee injury that cost him 11 games last year. They were down another one of their starting safeties, Bobby McCain, for the second half of the season. So they get healthy. And then on top of that, they bring in Byron Jones and Kyle Van Noy and Emmanuel Ogba and Shaq Lawson, and they use the number 30 overall pick on Noah Igbahogany, a very nice nickel corner out of Auburn. They're going to play a ton of press man. They're going to be in your face. It's going to give them the opportunity to blitz you a lot. I think the Dolphins, my personal expectation is 7 or 8 wins. I think the absolute ceiling's 9. I think everything would have to possibly go right for this team to have a winning record, because there are so many new pieces. There's so many questions still on the offensive line. And I think that's what makes the matchup, when you think about what Arizona is going to want to do and what Miami is going to want to do. Miami is going to thrive in nickel. and Arizona with Cliff Kingsbury, they're going to space the field. So it kind of goes in a, into a strength versus strength component from each team when these two guys are going head to head. I would love to see Tua starting at this point so we could get a Kyler versus Tua duel between those two guys. I will say this, for Miami matching up with Arizona, the addition of Byron Jones and the addition of DeAndre Hopkins makes this a much more fun matchup, because I think Arizona's offense, Miami's defense is the strength of this. I think Arizona being at home, they're probably going to be in an advantage, and I would expect they will probably win the football game. But I think that is a heavyweight slugfest between those two players individually, those two units separately, and exciting to see it play out.
Well, appreciate your time, Kyle. That's Kyle Krabs, DolphinsWire.USAToday.com. Kyle, can people find you on social media?
Sure. I'm on Twitter. I'm at Grinding the Tape. Always watching football players somewhere in some way, shape, or form. So at Grinding the Tape on Twitter. And as you mentioned, I'm over at Dolphins Wire for all daily Dolphins coverage. And enjoying this build up to training camp, and hoping we really get this thing off and going here and we can enjoy some football.
Absolutely. Thanks for your time, Kyle. And that, folks, wraps up episode 273 of the Rise Up Secret podcast. We still have one show left without Seth, where we got the final five, so it's a extra grande, supersized preview show for one of the for the Cardinals' last five opponents. Next week on the Rise Up Secret podcast, we will speak with writers about the Buffalo Bills, New England Patriots, LA Rams, New York Giants, and Philadelphia Eagles. That's all coming up next week. Thanks for listening. We'll have a new show then. Go Cardinals. Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up, Sea Red. Whoa!